to Gay Time TV, the first ever lesbian and gay series on the BBC.
Of the four of us in the studio this evening, two are transsexuals awaiting sexual conversion surgery, and the other two, including myself, are what are known as sex changers.
And they said, oh, well, everybody thinks you were a lesbian yourself. And I said, well, I am. What are you going to do about it?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. U.S. lawsuits target Trump's rights rollbacks, COVID-19 strikes down LGBTQ community events, and the BBC looks back at its queer coverage. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 21st, 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic has not stopped efforts to suppress the rights of LGBTQ people or the struggle to protect them. The Trump administration is being sued on two fronts. One lawsuit challenges the recent creation of a State Department Human Rights Commission. The other targets the Health and Human Services Department over discriminatory healthcare policies. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo first announced last July the creation of a new Commission on Unalienable Rights to be based on natural law and natural rights. Anti-marriage equality campaign star Brian Brown called it an extraordinary opening to overturn LGBTQ rights. In fact, 7 of the 10 people named to the commission by the evangelical Christian Pompeo have publicly expressed anti-queer views. They're all described as religious conservatives. They reportedly first met in October. Democracy Forward filed the lawsuit in federal court in New York on March 6th. The legal watchdog group, formed shortly after Trump's inauguration, is representing several clients, including the Council for Global Equality, Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, the Center for Health and Gender Equity, and the Global Justice Center. The lawsuit complains that most of these members hold well-documented views that privilege religious liberty above all other fundamental human rights. It also warns that they treat with skepticism or outright derision rights claimed by lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and intersex individuals, proponents of gender parity, and women and girls seeking access to sexual and reproductive health and rights. Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights President Kerry Kennedy told the McClatchy News Service that the Trump administration is looking to strip away the universality of human rights and hand over who gets rights and who doesn't to religious sects and autocrats.
Democracy Forward is also one of the groups leading the charge in a lawsuit challenging the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In November, the Trump administration filed a notice of non-enforcement of an Obama-era rule banning anti-queer discrimination by agencies the department funded. The reversal would allow such federally funded organizations to deny service to LGBTQ people based on religious beliefs. The fight on behalf of the True Colors United, Family Equality, and the Queer Seniors Support Group, SAGE, was joined by queer legal advocacy group Lambda Legal. Their lawsuit filed on March 19th claims that defendants have engaged in systematic efforts to undermine the civil rights of and non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people in the United States. Puneet Chima is a Lambda Legal attorney who's working on the lawsuit. She warns that the proposed policy reversal is particularly alarming in the age of the COVID-19 pandemic. LGBTQ people would be disproportionately affected, as Chima explained to NBC News. Youth who are experiencing homelessness and seniors who have difficulties accessing health care generally may have heightened need for care and heightened vulnerability in this epidemic. The November notice of non-enforcement disingenuously claims that the Trump administration is committed to fully enforcing the civil rights laws passed by Congress. The Equality Act that would protect LGBTQ people from bias under federal law has languished in Congress for years in various forms. The latest version, passed by Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic-controlled House, will never see the light of day in Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's Republican-controlled Senate.
The groundbreaking election of a transgender judge and the defeat of an anti-queer Democrat in Illinois were nearly drowned out on U.S. primary night by Joe Biden's apparent clinching of the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Trans attorney Jill Rose Quinn was among four victorious LGBTQ judicial candidates in the state on March 17th. She won the Democratic primary to fill a vacant seat on the Chicago-based Cook County Circuit Court. Her many endorsers included Chicago's out lesbian mayor, Lori Lightfoot. With no Republican opponent in the November general election, Quinn is on track to become the first transgender person to be elected to any office in Illinois. She'll also be the fourth out transgender judge in the U.S. The Windy City Times reported that out Democratic judicial candidates Michael Forte and Mary Catherine Marubio also won primaries to fill vacancies. Out candidate Lavander Smith was appointed to the bench last year and ran unopposed in his bid for election. None of those candidates have Republican opposition for the November general elections.
With 90% of the vote in, Marie Newman was declared the winner of the Democratic primary in Illinois' 3rd Congressional District. Wayward incumbent Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski opposes the Equality Act. The Roman Catholic lawmaker was the only Democrat to sponsor the First Amendment Defense Act, which would allow anti-queer bias based on religious belief. He also opposes a woman's right to choose. Newman narrowly edged out Lipinski by a 4-point margin. In her victory speech, Newman declared that we are going to work together to lower health care costs, to fight climate change, and to continue building a hospitable community for everyone.
From the massive to the intimate, more LGBTQ events have become victims of the COVID-19 pandemic. This year's queer fan favorite Eurovision Song Contest has been canceled. A number of local annual pride festivals around Australia have been canceled, hoping to return in 2021. So have the finals of the Mr. Gay Pride Australia competition. The Pride in Sports Awards and Australian LGBTQ Inclusion Awards have both been postponed until later this year. The Melbourne Queer Film Festival has canceled all remaining events. In the quickly evolving situation that has already shuttered most LGBTQ eateries and night spots, gatherings of more than 100 people are now banned in Australia. The LGBTQ travel and hospitality industries are also taking a beating.
For the first time in its 12-year history, Singapore's world-famous Pink Dot Pride celebration will move from its traditional free speech area in Hong Lim Park to a live-streamed event. Instead of wearing the unifying pink in the park, participants will be encouraged to light up their homes and workplaces in pink on June 27th. In the U.S., Immigration Equality is postponing its 25th anniversary Safe Haven Awards. Similar events planned by the Human Rights Campaign and by the media watchdog group GLAAD have also been postponed or canceled.
In the U.S., the U.K., and across Europe, Pride festivals and parades have virtually ended for the time being. It's curtains for the BFI Flare International LGBT Plus Film Festival that's been held in London since 1986. And as the Advocate noted, the COVID-19 pandemic has shut down at least one gay adult film studio. No more needed distractions from Miami-based Charge Media for a while.
Republican lawmakers in the U.S. state of Tennessee were not too busy with COVID-19 this week to harass queers. The state has yet to close its public schools because of the pandemic, but they did pass a bill to ban transgender girls from competing in school athletics. No trans teen has ever tried to be an athlete in Tennessee. The bill awaits the signature of Republican Governor Brad Little.
While the state's doctors were scrambling to keep up with the pandemic, the Republican majority in the Alabama State Senate was scrambling to make it a felony for doctors to treat transgender children under the age of 19 with the care they need. That would include prescribing puberty blockers and hormones or providing other parent-approved care.
On the other hand, COVID-19 has forced at least one conversion therapy church to cancel faith healing visits to hospitals. On its website, Redding, California's Bethel Church promotes the story of a lesbian who became heterosexual after studying Christian doctrine. Meanwhile, Australia's favorite holier-than-thou queer rights opponent and tennis champ, Margaret Court, announced that her church will continue to hold services because the blood of Jesus will protect the congregation. The website notes that hand sanitizer will also be available.
Needless to say, more than one right-wing Christian or Muslim cleric has directly blamed the advance of queer rights for the COVID-19 pandemic. After President Akufo-Addo announced a ban on usual meetings, weddings, and other mosque gatherings, Ghana's chief imam broadcast his own message. Dr. Sheikh Usman Sharubutu inexplicably called on Akufo-Addo to specifically ban meetings of LGBTQ people because their actions are demonic and shameful. Last week it was homophobia, not the pandemic, which led the government to ban a planned regional conference of the global queer rights group, ILGA, set for Accra in July.
Finally, professional homophobe Brian Fisher wrote on the far-right American Family Association's website that COVID-19 has a silver lining. Fisher writes that the stay-home orders being issued in more and more places will protect children from what he calls being brainwashed into normalizing sexual deviancy, gender confusion, and drag queen story hours.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 21st, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is usually recorded in the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, but we're recording remotely during the COVID-19 emergency. The news is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to NewsWrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Stay safe.
Stay healthy.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
I've always known this is a pandemic. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic.
You're with the BBC.
The British Broadcasting Corporation holds a legendary and sometimes infamous place in media history. In its mission to act in the public interest, its record of covering LGBTQ issues has been complicated. This Way Out's William Broom in Sydney spoke with the London-based archivist who's spearheading the online History of the BBC project's in-depth look at that record.
Hello, John Eskin. Welcome to This Way Out. You've been working on a fascinating project launched in February to mark LGBT plus History Month in the UK. And it looks at the history of the BBC's LGBTIQ coverage, particularly in terms of how the broadcaster has understood LGBTQI issues over the years. Could you tell us a bit more about the idea behind the project?
Well, it's part of the BBC's Oral History Project. We have an archive of recordings with former BBC staff dating back to the early 70s. So they started being collected then because it was the 50th anniversary of the BBC. Mm. And the then director or former director of radio, Frank Gillard, local radio, realised that there are a number of very key people in the BBC who were basically getting very old and their voices and memories needed to be memorialised. And as it was LGBTQI plus History Month here in the UK, I realised there were big gaps in this oral history collection. And where were the staff from the LGBT plus community? Mm. Practically invisible, but some relatively big names in terms of television and radio production, basically not present in the collection. So
yes,
we ought to really catch up here, get some basic key moments in the can. And we've created a website, which is part of the History of the BBC website, which is starting to build that collection of interviews.
For you, why is the project so important?
Well, as a gay man coming out in the early 90s, I came out of around about 21, 22, a relative late starter in some people's books. I had been aware of sort of my sexuality kind of up to that point, but did nothing about it. I had this very strong image in my head of what a gay man should look like. And at that time, it was, you know, you wore a tight white T-shirt and you shaved your head. Mm. And that was it. And I thought, well, I can't possibly be gay because I don't look like that. It was really as bizarre as a logic or illogic as that. And one program came along a few years later, after basically coming to terms with things, in 1995, called Gay Time TV, which was...
Yes.
Yeah, BBC's first nationwide lesbian, gay, trans program.
Hello and welcome to Gay Time TV, the first ever lesbian and gay series on the BBC.
That's right. For the next 6 weeks, we'll be here queering your pitch with a brand new magazine show about lesbian and gay life.
The BBC had never done anything like it before. And for me, it really opened things up and it just showed that LGBTQ plus people can be anything. And that was a real eye-opener.
Tonight on Gay Time TV, we bring you a special report on Pride. Rona gets to meet Martina Navratilova. We show you how to have fun in South Beach, Miami, and take a sneaky peek behind the scenes of the world's first all-gay soap. Get used to it. And later on, I'll be talking to gay hero, performer, writer and star Harvey Fierstein.
And Harvey will also be singing for us live in the studio.
And I thought, well, let's start with this collection of memories about LGBTQ plus people in the BBC by looking at Gay Time TV and looked at the cast. We've interviewed the cast and crew who originally worked on it and the presenters who originally worked on it and put together some web content, basically covering the ins and outs, the highs and lows, the ups and downs of the whole thing.
Yes. It was a great programme. And I remember, on the one hand, they'd cover things like the Soho bombings and then they'd have a mass gay wedding. So there was really something for everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the whole key to it. The first two presenters were Rona Cameron and Bert Tyler Moore. I put the question, would you create a programme like this today? Mm. And they kind of looked at me and went, well, no, not really, because it seems rather a curious thing to kind of lump all LGBTQ plus minority interests, if you like, into one half an hour slot late at night on a Thursday evening and kind of tick a box and say, oh, that's great. Well, that's not good enough. And I think the programme came along at a time when the BBC, certainly as a public service broadcaster, was starting to wake up and think, well, LGBTQ plus people are licence fee payers too. In the UK, you have to pay a licence fee to have a television at the moment. It might not last long, given the current circumstances, but we'll wait and see. The rules are that you have to have a pay for a licence and to watch television. And the BBC at the time was thinking, well, how can we serve all these different audiences? Suddenly kind of woken up to. And they had an African Caribbean unit, they had an Asian unit, and somebody woke up and thought, well, we ought to do something for the gays. I remember this being discussed. The gays need to be served. And I think it came out of that tradition, really, a kind of early awakening about what minorities really mean in terms of broadcasting.
Because it has been pretty scant, LGBTIQ broadcasting in the past, and when you read about it, you would be forgiven for thinking that it all started around 1965 with Round the Horn, but it didn't start then, did it? It went way back. I think on your website you mentioned a 1955 program, a radio program about homosexuals and Christianity.
Yes, that's right. That's the first actual dedicated program we can find in the archive. It doesn't mean to say there wasn't a kind of mention of the subject. In 1953, we found some documents. We have a timeline on our website, basically, which looks at key moments in the BBC's LGBTQ plus history. And in 1953, there was, within a succession of a month, really, in the same month, 1953, in November, a discussion about, you know, should this be a suitable discussion for radio? You know, they hadn't even that far. One of these memos from the chief assistant talk says, I have made some further inquiries about homosexuality and the answer convinces me that so far as broadcasting is concerned, it would be a waste of time to do any serious work on the subject. I'm satisfied that it would not be acceptable, an acceptable subject in our media. Which is extraordinary. That's the 9th of November. And then by the 19th of November, 1953, another memo comes through and says the problem of broadcasting a talk about this subject was discussed. The general feeling was that the subject should be treated in broadcasting if a suitable means of doing so could be devised. So they got as far as understanding that, well, it's an issue. Let's find a way of devising some means of talking about it.
Yes.
But a long way off, you know, really any kind of substantial programming.
More substantial conversation with BBC historian John Eskelm in a moment.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out. That was without cue cards, people.
There's nothing cooler than the world's only international LGBT radio magazine.
Unless it's thiswayout.org.
At thiswayout.org, you'll find program information,
related videos,
expanded features,
news wrap transcripts,
CDs, and downloadable materials.
It might not be cooler than radio,
but there's much more This Way Out at thiswayout.org.
Now let's get back to William Broom's chat with the BBC's John Eskelm.
Whenever you see timelines in the history of broadcasting, LGBTIQ broadcasting, it always seems to be very male-dominated. There doesn't seem to be as much mention of, say, lesbians, bisexuals, or trans people. Why do you think that is?
Men in broadcasting have traditionally always dominated broadcasting, so the sheer presence of men taking the decisions and the decision makers, unfortunately, still are, by and large, men. Just basically have not been looking out beyond their own immediate needs and prism. So, you know, at the top, you've got that kind of problem. The BBC, again, doing its very best to address that. But I think that may account for some of the early decisions. When you get in the 1970s, there was basically a community program unit set up, which produced a weekly program called Open Door.
Yes.
Which is extraordinary. And we've got an example of an edition from 1973, when the Transsex Liberation Group were given free rein to produce its own program.
Of the four of us in the studio this evening, two are transsexuals awaiting sexual conversion surgery, and the other two, including myself, are what are known as sex changers, woman born of man. We're first going to show you a short film telling you something about each one of us.
Every time this program went out, it went on for a couple of years, I think, a local group would be encouraged to take over the editorial control of half an hour of television programming late at night on the second national channel, so not prime time by any means, but given complete editorial control and a sort of final sign-off by the BBC and help in production. And this particular program that we've got on the website, the Transsex Liberation Group, a group of male to female trans people representing this community group, discussing their lives. It's largely focused on their problem, as they frame it. It's not particularly celebratory, although it is an early attempt at saying, look, here we are as a group, we're celebrating us as people in our own right. We're not talking at you through kind of a mediated level of people looking in at us like a kind of zoo, but here we are talking about our own experience.
It was fascinating because
forward. Yeah.
I was utterly unfamiliar with it until I checked out your project online. And I was quite surprised to see such a discussion show in 1973. Two of the programmes I was very familiar with was Man Alive in 1967. I think there were two episodes. One was on gay men and the other was on lesbians.
There was a discussion, and I got hot and bothered because of things that were said and flared up in defence, and they said, oh, well, everybody think you were a lesbian yourself. And I said, well, I am. What are you going to do about it? You know, they sort of looked at me and said, oh, are you? Well, you're all right. It didn't make any difference afterwards.
It wasn't always positive. They were often portrayed as victims or in shadows.
That's right. So this was a series, Man Alive. It was about the human condition. It had been going for a number of years. It was a regular slot. And these two programs were called Consenting Adults 1, the Men, Consenting Adults 2, the Women. And these went out on a sort of, well, mid-evening slot, 8:05 on a Wednesday in the summer. And again, on the second channel, so not exactly big viewing figures, or primetime slot. But these two programmes were just after the UK's Sexual Offences Act law had been passed. So that was the sort of basic partial decriminalisation of gay sex between men in the UK. Lesbians never featured in UK law. But the two programmes kind of marked this. As I mentioned earlier, this idea of looking in at a community group.
Yes.
So it is this kind of, you're in a zoo, and here we are as the heterosexual viewer. Obviously, we're all heterosexual, looking in at you and seeing what you do as this slightly mysterious and very hidden kind of group. And the same applies for Consulting Adults to the Women. Very peculiar questions such as who of you does the DIY? And it's very interesting because the interviewees just kind of look at each other and go, we never even considered the question. What are you talking about? And they just kind of work it out. You know, oh, well, I suppose I do a bit more of the plumbing when it comes up. But their reactions are fantastic, and they rather put the interviewer in their place.
The question sounds so archaic by today's standards.
Yeah, they are. And it just shows you how incredibly strong opposite sex conceptual notions of what things were and obviously must be, how strong those heteronormative things really were.
Two of the people I loved growing up were Larry Grayson and John Inman. But of course, a lot of the gay liberationists didn't like them at all. But there's been a lot of revisionism lately about them and an appreciation. Where do you stand?
William Broom's chat with the BBC's John Escombe continues next time on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Michael Taylor Gray, produced by Brian DeShazer, and from William Broom. Thanks also to Rob LaCrone and Laura Dickinson-Turner. One Direction and Brad Paisley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Together with all of our listener donors, they make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KPFT Houston, Texas, WRIR Richmond, Virginia, 3CH Woodend, Victoria, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay tuned and stay healthy.